Hi, everybody. It's Gustavo, the host of the Enabled Disabled podcast. A quick physical description of myself. I am a middle-aged Latin American male. I have dark brown hair parted in the middle, and I am wearing a black polo shirt in my living room. And I am super excited to introduce Daniel DeFabio from Global Genes. He's also the founder of the Disorder Channel. He's been involved with the Rare Disease Film Festival, and he is just an incredibly accomplished, empathetic, intelligent human being. And we're going to have a really interesting discussion around disability and rare diseases. Daniel, thank you so much for being here. It's an absolute pleasure.
Thank you so much for having me. And if you're going to cop to being middle-aged, I have to too, because I'm clearly older. So for my visuals, I wear glasses, I have a beard, I have a shaved head. Today I'm wearing a pale green collared shirt, and my virtual environment around me is looking as though there were a television behind me that says the Disorder Channel.
Awesome. So I think your childhood is super interesting. I want to start there to just give people an idea of, you know, all these cool interests that you started to develop. You were really into video games and computers as a kid, right?
Yeah, I was. This was the 80s, the first personal computers. I wanted an Atari. I didn't get one. Instead, I got a TI-99/4A, but it had some good graphics capabilities, and I really focused on that. And I make my own versions of like Pac-Man or Centipede or other games, often getting the graphics better than ever making the game work. But it was a good learning experience. And it was, in hindsight, at one point in my career, I ended up being involved in web design when that was a brand new industry. But in hindsight, I can see a through line from all of that, that was both embracing new media as it comes, but consistently looking for storytelling opportunities. It's whether it would be video games, film, web series, TV commercials, the common thread has always been storytelling.
Interesting.
And rare disease advocacy, still storytelling.
So, yeah. So as I'm a gamer myself. I don't play all that much anymore because of time, but I still love games. But most people don't think of video games, at least not back then, as a storytelling opportunity. So how did you see that connection? Or when did you see that connection while you were exploring, you know, making games?
It's a good question. I don't know if it happened earlier. It definitely happened when I was in the early days of web series and internet content. That would be the 90s. We had many brainstorming sessions sitting around saying, if this is a new medium and we're going to tell stories in it, how is that the same as video games or different than video games? And the thinking was, when the bandwidth allows the video game people to do their thing online, because this is like the days of dial-up modems, so that just was not possible. But if and when it was possible, and by today it is, we all play games online, they would take away our market advantage, right? We were pioneering something, and we were thinking it was this new form of storytelling, and it was it. We did some interactive storytelling. We were, depending on how you count, probably the second web series ever. I was at a company called Digital Planet when we did something called Madeline's Mind, which was the first web series to use animation to tell the story. But we made sure that it wasn't just a cartoon online. It was an interactive experience. So it had elements of like the game Myst, where a little bit of choose your own adventure, or just you might not even know it, but psychologically, if you clicked the left side of the screen or the right side of the screen, one was lighter, one was darker, and you just thought you were clicking to advance the story, but you're influencing the story. So yeah, we spent a lot of time thinking about what could new types of storytelling be.
Interesting. And what did you learn in that thought process that you carried forward into your other ventures?
There were things I had to learn or happened to learn about game theory and the prisoner's dilemma. And if you know that at all, there's like mutually assured destruction type things. You know, people don't make the best choice just for themselves all the time. They might calculate the worst choice for their opponent rather than the best choice for themselves, things like that. And that, some of that, you know, I now, you know, don't want to be competitive. I'm in a space where I want to be very collaborative and cooperative, and I want to help others. And but even that, just knowing that you may misunderstand people's best intentions, right? And I learned some of that from gameplay, cooperative gameplay or competitive gameplay. And I now have a bit of advice for myself and anyone else who wants to listen, that I want to meet people more than halfway, because halfway might not be a strong enough connection. If you think of like two by fours coming together, you know, if you need to span 4 feet, don't give me two lengths of 2 feet. Give me more than that so I can better connect them, right? So that's, I don't know, maybe a little epiphany I had or something I hope that I can live by, is that if I think I'm doing my half of the equation, maybe that's still not enough, right?
Interesting. So why, and I love that analogy of the 2x4, but what makes you, or what gives you the inspiration or the desire to make, to go that extra step when most people wouldn't? Why is the connection so important to you?
Yeah, it's, I think the lack of connection is, it's where things break down. It's misunderstandings happen, you know, good intentions on both sides, but we didn't understand each other's intentions. So I think a lot of, at least for me, a lot of it falls into that category of, be sure you're doing more than you think you need to do. And it goes into communication too, and maybe storytelling as well. You know, I think the army tells their people, you know, you, when you give instructions, you tell them what you're going to say, you say it, and then you recap what you just said, right? And that sounds like extra effort, but it's actually usually necessary, you know, to be very clear, to make sure there's no misunderstandings.
So how do you make the calculation of, is this something that you just try to do no matter what, or do you make the calculation like, this connection or this piece of storytelling or this relationship is important enough where I'm going to do that?
Yeah, that's interesting. Yeah, because if you think about like the teachable moments, right? If you have a disability, if you're ever in a disease, there's so many opportunities like that, that, you know, do I want to get into it? Do I want to educate this person who may be misunderstanding or judging or whatever? And if you're in your best mindset, you're like, that's a teachable moment. I'm going to embrace this. I'm going to go the extra, you know, I might be in a hurry right now, but I'm going to, in my son's case, he had Menkes syndrome. So I know why you're staring at my son. I can explain it to you. You might benefit from the knowledge. You might, you know, who knows the effect this could have. You might be a doctor or a nurse or something that could really benefit from the knowledge. But then there's, we're all human. There's days like, I got to get moving. I'm running late and I don't have time to talk to you about this. And I'm going to let your, whatever it was, your rude look or your strange question, I'm just going to let that fall by the wayside and I can't get into it. So yeah, there is, you're right. There's a calculus to be made. When and for whom is extra effort worth the effort? Yeah.
Yeah. So let's talk about Lucas. He was the impetus behind you getting involved and starting to kind of reframe your life and what you wanted to do and get involved with the rare disease community and the disability space, correct?
Yeah, I wouldn't have known what rare diseases were. Certainly didn't know what Menkes disease was. And Lucas was my first child. And within the first year, we saw enough delays that we knew to look for a genetic, someone told us, you need to be looking for a genetic diagnosis. And you've probably heard enough of these stories that can take people years to get to a rare disease diagnosis. And it's a little inappropriate to say we were lucky, but we did not have to wait years. We had to wait a couple of months. And we had our diagnosis. Unfortunately, it was a terrible one. Menkes syndrome means you have a mutation of the ATP7A gene. So you're not producing or transporting enough copper in the body. Well, transporting enough copper properly in the body. And again, something I never would have known. You and I and most people that are not with a genetic variant are getting enough copper in our diet without ever trying. You don't have to think about it. And it's building our muscles and our brains and surprisingly our hair. So for Lucas, he was probably transporting some of that, but not enough of that. So he was given a prognosis. Most kids, usually boys with Menkes, live 3 to 10 years. And that will change everything. You know, everything you thought about what parenting a child would be like kind of gets upended. And the collapse timeline, you know, it's now things are precious and every life is precious, and whether it's 80 years or 10 years. But when you think it's 10 years, you start to shape things differently or focus on things differently. And, you know, some people pile things into the bucket list and we've got to get this, this, and this done because we've only got 10 years to do them. And other people are like, and I think maybe I was more in this camp, we're not going to sweat the small stuff. And a lot of it is small stuff. And maybe if there's any advantage in this, maybe the wake-up call of a shortened lifespan is that perspective that if it's not an existential problem, if it's not life and death, maybe I don't have to even worry about it being a problem. You know, things like, I don't know, the rat race and, you know, is my job good enough? Am I making enough money? Or is my car new enough? You know, all those things kind of went out the window. I sometimes refer to it as game over, not like giving up, but playing games. That's funny. We started on video games, playing games. There's no time for that. We're down to serious business and serious enjoyment. And luckily for us on the enjoyment side, Lucas was so happy. I mean, he didn't speak, but his laughter spoke volumes and his eyes communicated a lot. And his joy guided us and sort of educated us and refocused us. And, you know, we wanted his quality of life and we kind of measured that by joy. And he was quick to laugh. He laughed a lot. And he probably, you know, I don't know if you or I spend maybe half of our time pretty happy and half of our time not so happy. I swear he was about 80% happy all the time. And that's good. I mean, didn't mean there's pain and suffering for him too, but it's really interesting that how much I had to rethink, you know, what is important and what are we trying to achieve here? We didn't, you know, we were told he wouldn't walk and he wouldn't talk. And we didn't get super aggressive with the therapies that may have changed that or may have worked in the other direction. We also didn't just ignore those possibilities. I mean, he did have some of those therapies, but we always kept in balance, like, is this an unreasonable workload for this young boy for a result that is probably unlikely? You know, I mean, it's more than unlikely. We were told it wouldn't happen. So, you know, do you want to just be defiant and working against, you know, I'm going to refuse to accept the negative here that my son will never walk and I'm going to do everything possible to make sure he walks. And some people I know are in that situation. They do heroic things and with good results. And, you know, I don't think my wife or I like to second guess ourselves. I don't think we made too many bad choices with Lucas. So, you know, it does still tend to boil down to me, you know, was he happy? And yes, he was most of the time. But yeah, you're right. This all launched me in a very different direction. And the maybe first step of that took a while to get over the shocks and adapted to the new lifestyle and the new parenting style. But eventually I wrote a blog piece about what this change of expectations meant to me, and how I was rethinking parenting because of it. And then writing that piece let me know that it wasn't just for my benefit. It might have been, as I wrote it, it could have just been me getting it off my chest and out into the world. But people responded to it in a way that let me know it served a purpose for others, not just for me. And that gave me a little push to, I had made some films in the past, and that was kind of my career path. And I thought I should make a film about Lucas and other kids that have Menkes disease. And, you know, I can tend to sometimes be a procrastinator. So it wasn't hard for me to get the interviews with the other families that had Menkes children. But when it came time to get my own, you'd think that's the easiest one to get. We're all right here in the house. And I kept putting it off and putting it off. And then I had to kind of remind myself, you know, when you feel a need in the world, whether it's, you know, we should have less world hunger, or we should stop climate change, or whatever, you know that someone should do that. But it could be kind of easy to think, but that someone's not me. You know, I'm not uniquely suited to this task, so I'm not the one who's going to take this on. But when it came to this project, there's so few people that face Menkes syndrome. And how many of those would have filmmaking skills? So if it wasn't going to be me in this situation, I didn't know who would ever do it. And so that kind of pushed me through my tendency to procrastinate. And I felt there was a need because, like so many people do, you get a diagnosis and you Google it, and the black and white data there is terrible. You know, they don't sugarcoat the WebMD stuff or the NIH reports or whatever it is. And you are faced with, in my son's case, kind of a death sentence. And I wanted the next people that did that Google search to find other information, not contradictory. I wasn't going to contradict the facts, but I placed those facts in my film into a context so that you can see, yes, those horrible prognosis and diagnosis facts and symptoms are true, but you still get to have a good life, some duration of life with your child. And by putting it in that context, I hope that it was a relief to the people that came up behind me getting this diagnosis too. And I'm pleased that, you know, the video did well in terms of search results and views online and things like that. So if you search it now, you still find all that dire medical data, but in the results are also this video that gives you a little, it's called Menkes disease, finding help and hope. So there's hopefully serving both of those purposes, where to find the help and provide a tone or a note of hope.
And I know your blog post won an award. Global Genes gave you an award in the film as well. So I think there's so much there to explore. There's this whole idea. I've talked about this with Kimberly Warner before, and another writer named Rebecca Tosig, who's also she's a wheelchair user. And there's this whole framework that we fall into as people, generally speaking, I think, of an either or, like it's either this or it's that, right? So I have a disease or a disability, that's bad. My life is going to be more difficult. I'm going to have a bunch of things to overcome, right? But we experience life when we have, I think, some brain power and perspective and empathy as a both and. You can go through life with a rare disease, however long that is, and still have a nuanced, rich, happy, joyous life and bring joy to so many people. It's both. It's both and. It's not an either or. Does that resonate with you?
Oh, absolutely. You know, I think whatever terms we land on, you know, we say special needs kids, and some people take exception to that. And the word special is tricky there, because I think the kids are extra special, you know, to be celebrated. But the phrase can sometimes mean that the needs are extraordinary. And that's all calibrated against ableism, right? So they need to do this or that to what? To be like the norm? And the norm is, you know, so I can think of, we probably as a community, we haven't landed on a great term. You know, differently abled was popular for a little while. And that has its strengths in terms of, you know, language choice, but extraordinary, you know, that could be a good term for some people. But I wonder, you know, where are we falling short in embracing differences, celebrating differences, that, you know, Lucas wasn't, we weren't going to get him up to the expectations of a typically healthy kid his age, whether it's for walking, talking, academic understanding, any of that. But he had amazing other things to contribute. And, you know, I don't think we have much language for appreciating differences that are different, but possibly better or also good, right? So, you know, something, it sounds a little wishy-washy, but something like a connection Lucas could make with his eyes that I can't make, and I don't know, the rest of my family can't make, and he would, whatever you want to call it, reach into people's souls or form a connection that was meaningful with no words. And, you know, if we could all wish for it, don't we all want something like that? But in his case, it's all viewed in a medical model of almost deficiencies, differences that are deficient, right? Can't talk, but can pierce your brain with his eyeballs. I mean, that's pretty cool, you know? So yeah, there's we don't have real good language for some of these things. It's who's coining all the terms, right? If the majority of people are able-bodied, they're gonna use terminology that favors their outlook, I suppose.
Yeah, it goes into a lot of interesting, that's an interesting philosophical point. And when you talk about expectations, I think it's also, I want to tease that out a little bit more, because you reset your expectations for Lucas, but I think in a net positive way. I think it's really powerful to go through life saying, I don't want to play the same status game that everybody else is playing. This is actually a bunch of masks and roles that we put on to fit in or get ahead or do things that, is that ultimately what gives my life meaning at the end of it or through it? And your answer was, well, I don't think so. I think there's so much more here that we can experience as people that I want to soak in and absorb and learn and enjoy while I have the opportunity to do so.
Yeah, and I think we were able to take some good cues from Lucas on that. You know, so an example might be, we never got around to doing a Make-A-Wish, which he certainly could have qualified for and would have been a good candidate for, but it felt a little bit to us, if he couldn't communicate to us what his wish was, then we'd just be forcing something on him and taking a guess that, oh, he'd love to go swim with the dolphins. Well, maybe he would, but maybe not. And the cues we got from him instead were what he liked most was real close family time on the couch. And family included my wife, my other son, Alex, myself. And we were fortunate to have a home care nurse about 40 hours a week. And she was definitely family. And so if those people were near him, and maybe extended family, grandparents or cousins or someone, if they were near him, he was thrilled, and the closer, the better. You know, there were times, because he was, even though he lived to be 11 and a half, he never got that tall. We might take him out of his wheelchair and put him on a surface sometimes. And, you know, it could be a couch or whatever, but there's also times, it sounds a little silly, but we could put him flat on the middle of a table and everybody's gathered, like a centerpiece or something. Everybody's gathered around this table and there he is. And he'd love that. And the point of this is that he didn't have a need to have a destination trip, go to the theme park or whatever, the type of thing you think of with Make-A-Wish. His needs were simpler. His needs were literally closer to home. And I think that kept us a little bit in check. Another aspect of the, we don't have much time with this child, could be an impulse to, well, let's spoil him like crazy. Let's give him everything. But the things we could tell he wanted were such simple things. And they were maybe easily forgotten for everyone living their day-to-day grind life. But it really made us slow down and refocus and rethink. Prioritizing him in at where he was.
How did you teach his brother to appreciate and understand and connect with Lucas?
Yeah, that's interesting because Alex is younger, 2 years younger, so he didn't know a different experience. It was his normal. He didn't know another sibling dynamic other than with Lucas and his unique situation. Lucas thought Alex was the greatest thing. If of anyone coming close to Lucas, if it was Alex, that was the greatest joy. And again, the closer the better, and he would shriek with delight. But then also, because especially when Alex was very young, he sort of toddler unpredictable motions or, faster moving than the adults or whatever it was. But Lucas would sort of put his guard up a little bit, like, I love this, but this could go bad. And one of the last pictures, we lost Lucas in 2020. One of the last pictures I have of him is that we took him. Normally he'd either be in a wheelchair or he'd be laying flat, but we positioned him on the couch next to his brother in a seated position. You just had to keep a hand on him because he might not stay supported that way. But for him to not only be near his brother, but in a similar posture to his brother, he just lit up and it made his day. It's such a great photo for us to look back on and know what was going on in his head so clearly. It's like, I get to do what he does. Yeah.
That's beautiful. Maybe a way we need to do an extended, a part two of this, but maybe a way for people to kind of help frame a little bit, just to touch the experience that you're talking about is, I was really close to my grandfather on, my mother's father. And because they were in Brazil and we were in the US, if we were lucky, we got to see them once a year. Usually it was every other year or et cetera, whenever we could. And he was like the glue of the family. He kept everybody together. To him, being together was where his joy came from. He lived a hard, complicated life. And whenever we went to visit, or when he came to visit us, my memories of him were just enjoying having dinner together, or when Christmas came around and his brother dressed up as Santa Claus, and just that feeling of that close-knit family unity, having watching a silly TV show after dinner, and just seeing him smile and his eyes light up. Those are the things that I hold on to, that for me, it made my experience and my time with him worthwhile.
Yeah, it's interesting you brought up your mom's dad, because my mom's pretty religious and her dad also Irish. And her dad would say about Lucas, "I'm praying for the miracle." And what he meant was some kind of cure, some kind of restorative, you know. And I love what my mom's answer to him was, which is, "Lucas is the miracle." And I believe that our experience with him was so unexpected, but amazing, you know, different, you know, wonderful. I mean, I don't want to downplay that there were hard times. There certainly were. There were stresses. There were medical complexities that I wouldn't wish on anybody. But the actual chance to enjoy a person, a loved one, a human being that is exceptional, it was amazing, I think. And not just like me, because I love him because I'm his dad, but I think strangers too. I think people responded to Lucas. He was unique.
He sounds like a very charismatic young boy, and that ability to connect. I've met people before like that, where just their look, you know, it says 1,000 words, and you don't even need to say anything. You're just in that moment with them. I know that I didn't have that experience exactly, but I can feel it. I can sense at least a part of it. How did you and your wife, two questions here. How did you and your wife kind of consistently recalibrate your perspective with him, you know, through the years? Like, how did you not fall into that rat race trap again, or the status trap again? Like, what kept you, how did you keep going back to what mattered?
Some of it wasn't, you know, us making deliberate choices. Some of it was being swept away in the current of, this is a different lifestyle with lots of hospital visits and therapies and things like that. And so a little bit, we didn't have time for nonsense. You know, we had to be very focused on the tasks, and we kept a pretty regimented schedule of his care. And, you know, even I, in hindsight now, I see some of the remarks from some of the doctors we dealt with, where they were appreciative, right? They were like responding with a little bit impressed, like, "Oh, you've really managed his care." And, but now I see it like, you guys might have been a little obsessive, but I think we were using the predictability of a schedule to make up for all the unpredictability that was coming our way. So that probably helped. I do know that it always felt we could handle it to the point we're at, but any one, two, or three more things would crush us. And sometimes they did. Sometimes, you know, something silly like a day-to-day thing, like, you know, you blew a tire on the car, and that's, you know, it's never fun, but most people can shrug it off to a certain degree, and it might be the thing that just snapped me, you know. But the more intentional stuff was that focus on what are truly important needs, you know, for Lucas and for us. You know, do we just need to spend more time with him, or take a pause and, you know, give ourselves relaxation time, rather than, I guess we did some of this too, but balancing out the let's work a problem here. The problem being, can we get better care? Can we get maybe towards a treatment or a cure for Menkes syndrome? Not always working a problem so that you don't want a child of yours to be partially or largely thought of as a problem to solve, you know, so kind of embracing the good, and there was a lot of good, in addition to, or sometimes instead of, focusing on medical tasks at hand, right? Complex care and all that.
That's a really good answer. How are you still staying true, you and your family still staying true to what that experience and what you've learned now?
It's funny. I wonder, you know, will I sort of snap back a little bit without this constant presence in our life to remind us? I'd like to think some of these are lifelong lessons and I'll keep them forever. But, you know, one, I guess if I were to name one, sort of in the rat race category of things we missed, was that we discovered we really couldn't do air travel with Lucas. It just wouldn't work. Not only because of the wheelchair aspect of that difficulty, but he didn't tolerate it well. And so we spent about 10 years not getting on airplanes, you know, keeping our travel limited to what we could do in a van. And so after Lucas died, one of our first instincts was, let's do some of that. Let's do some of that kind of travel we haven't been able to do. But it was during pandemic. You couldn't travel anyway. So I wonder if that kept us a little true there, you know, but then, like a lot of people, when the pandemic travel concerns eased a little bit, we did our share of traveling the last year. So, but I don't think we could ever let those things that I'll say creature comforts, you know, whatever they are, become too important to us, having learned the hard way what's important, right?
Yep. I would imagine that your work at Global Genes and the Disorder Channel also help keep a sense of what's important and what the meaning that you want to explore and help other people with understanding, correct? Like with the Disorder Channel, let's start there. How did that idea come about, and what's the big mission there that you're trying to accomplish?
Yeah, the mission is to increase awareness for rare diseases, and there's stories as told in film and video, and it's kind of an example. I think a lot of people in rare disease find some version of this. You know, if it's not out there, it doesn't exist, and you wish it existed, maybe you should be the one to make it happen. And that happened first with Bo Bigelow and I creating Disorder, the Rare Disease Film Festival. And then after two editions of that, Boston and then San Francisco, we thought we'd do New York, but pandemic came along and it was a really bad time to have possibly immunocompromised rare disease people gathering in a movie theater in New York City in May of 2020 was about the worst idea you could come up with. So we put that on hold, and we're still on hold. We're still looking for, is next year the year we can do a film festival in person? But given that we couldn't do that, what might we do instead? And I know a lot of film festivals went to a virtual experience. We didn't quite want that, but our version of that was to create the Disorder Channel and invite those same filmmakers that we knew. Do you want your film shown in this way? And then we found more films. And one of the great advantages compared to the film festival, where you can only program so many hours of films, and you may be saying no to some very good films. And sometimes that's because we already have our cystic fibrosis film, we can't show two, or we already have our Batten disease film, it wouldn't be right to show two. But now in this channel format, the content library could be infinite. And so why not put in seven films on cystic fibrosis, or you know, and if people choose, it's on demand. So if they choose to watch the next one after the next one and watch all seven, that's great. So yeah, I think, yeah.
Sorry, go ahead, please.
No, I just think it's an unintended consequence in a way. You know, we strongly prefer the in-person experience of the film festival because that allows these synergies and accidental meetings. And we think those, especially in the context of having just heard a rare disease story or 10 rare disease stories, gives the right people in the room the right springboard for a conversation that might lead to collaborations. Oh, do you know this researcher? Or you should talk to this friend that I know, and the way you and I met through Kimberly. You know, so that I think is the real value. We always say with our festival, we're not just curating films, we're curating the audience. Because it's not enough to watch the film and say, oh, that's too bad, or that's an amazing story. We want people to do something about it. And I'm not going to be the guy that moves the science forward personally, but I might introduce two people that do it. So that's the goal. That's the mission.
Your analogy of the 2x4 came into my head just now, because I'm thinking, you know, a film festival is more work. You have to bring the audience in there. You have to curate the right films, right? So you're going above and beyond to make the connection, to make sure that people are connecting, that synergies are happening, and that, you know, I think people forget the power of film is that I go back to growing up in Los Angeles, you know, as a young boy, the power of film was a crowded theater where a bunch of people are viscerally reacting and experiencing and enjoying together. And the next level of that is then they're connecting afterwards. They're talking, they're sharing their experience of what they just saw, what they just, you know, what they heard, how it changed their perspective maybe on their lives a little bit. It's really, really powerful that you're doing that.
Yeah, you're right. It is the shared experience. The dark room, the undivided attention, the feeling of community, and you know, so many of us, whether we're facing disabilities or rare diseases or both, have this feeling of isolation that others don't know what it's like for us. And for those 10 or 30 minutes in a movie theater, you are sharing the experience. You're vicariously experiencing it. And it gets us not all the way there, but onto a pretty good foundation for a conversation.
How do you curate the movies? How do you, like, what standards are there for a film to make it into the channel?
It's interesting. Like a lot of festivals, we use Film Freeway and people submit and we see what we get and we take a look. But there's a spectrum. When we first started, we didn't know there would be nearly enough films to even do a festival. We knew about five friends that had made advocacy films for their rare diseases. And we thought, well, we'll have those. And Bo had made one and I had made one, so we'd have those. But then they started to come in, and unsolicited, or, you know, people we didn't know, and people we were surprised to even learn about the disease we'd never heard of. And then there's a spectrum of, you'll appreciate this, production quality, right? There's people that very much DIY on their phone, and maybe it's more like a home movie, or maybe it's more amateurish and zero budget, zero crew. And then there's well-funded productions that really surprised us. Like, and you look at the credits roll, and a lot of people worked on that film, and, you know, they knew what they were doing, and it shows, you know, it's perfectly color graded and the score is beautiful and deliberate. And it would be easy to always pick the most polished productions, but there's an important message to be had from all of these films. So we're trying to create a mix. You know, we want some of the DIY shot it on your cell phone stuff mixed in with the, we had a budget and we traveled the world and captured great stories. And then there's a trickier element of, you would expect all these films to be documentaries and somewhat sad documentaries. And they are, although most tend to end on a note of hope. But Bo and I took a look at, could we find things that aren't documentaries or are unconventional documentaries? So we had some that were abstract experimental films that still told a rare disease story. Or we had some with puppets or beautiful Pixar level animation. And then we were always keeping an eye out, and they were very hard to find, but could there be a comedy about rare disease? And there are one or two of them, we've had them. And it's a very refreshing break in the programming to introduce those before everyone starts to feel overwhelmed with another tough documentary to watch, you know?
I also get the sense, though, that you don't want films that simply tell a sad story, right? It's not about that. There's more nuance and complexity there. You want to show the humanity of the experience. You want to show the joys of those moments with the people you love. You want to show the whole range of human experience, right? It's not limited to what we typically think of as, like you said, the sad documentary.
Yeah, it's not enough to be a sad story and give someone some emotional catharsis for, oh, poor that person, that was hard for them. We do want there to be something educational, something eye-opening or perspective-changing that you learn from that story. And a lot of the films, because they're documentaries, will also convey nuts and bolts of, here's what to look for if you think you might have this diagnosis, or here's what we're trying to accomplish in our research. And so there are some practical aspects to these too that get beyond, you know, sort of the emotional impact of the story. But they are, we wanted the audience to not be all us, meaning all directly affected or caregivers of rare disease people, because in a way we already have the message, we already have the perspective. We wanted to make sure that what we're doing might appeal to the general public, or at least appeal to researchers and clinicians and other people that are involved in rare disease but not directly affected by rare disease. And sure enough, it definitely works for them. We've had a lot of people in industry research come up to us afterwards and say, you've reminded me why I got into my career. You reminded me why I'm doing what I'm doing. And even some will say, you know, on a given disease, Goldenhar syndrome, I've been working on Goldenhar syndrome for 10 years. I've never met a patient personally. And now I've seen a patient's life up on the screen and it hits me, you know? So I think there's a lot of good to come of it other than sad stories with emotional outlets and, you know, that kind of, that's maybe what mainstream cinema accomplishes, right? Just emotional release and escapism and things like that. And we're trying to do something a little different.
Yeah. I want to talk about Global Genes, and I know that I don't want to take up too much of your time, but I'm wondering if there's also another avenue to explore with the Disorder Channel in this sense, right? We could probably do a whole podcast on many podcasts on the Hollywood gatekeepers, right? And what stories get in and what don't. But it seems to me like you have created a platform where you can start to reach out, and maybe you already have, to film students at the top, at some of the top film schools, or some animators who challenge them to tell, let's make a comedy around this condition. Let's make a really interesting animated series on where the characters have a disability or a rare disease, and let's tell a nuanced story through here as a way for them to put their work out there where it's not accepted, to experiment, to try something new, And who knows what that can generate as it moves forward.
Yeah, that's a fantastic idea. We are trying some things a little bit in that direction. But since you mentioned Global Genes, I not only work now at Global Genes full time, but they have seen some value in the disorder channel and will partner with. So I wear both hats, right? I wear the Global Genes hat and the disorder channel hat. And with them, we've developed a thing we're calling Rarely Told Stories, where we're teaching people who are advocates for rare disease how to make their films, usually documentaries. And actually, Kimberly Warner is one of the instructors of that program with us. We bring in four or five different filmmakers that have made a lot of rare disease films and usually won awards doing it. And, you know, try to break it down at a very basic level. And Kimberly's great at saying, you can do this on your phone. I'll show you how. So the barrier to entry isn't quite as intimidating, right? You don't have to have the big crew and the big budget. And so that's been a great project. We've done now three different workshops with them. We'll do another one next month. And we've seen some good films come out of it. And some of those might end up on the Disorder Channel, but certainly several of them are screening at Global Genes events. And the next one is, depending on when you release this episode, September 13th and 14th in San Diego, some of those films will show. And so that's going to be a good opportunity for them and us, right? They felt empowered and encouraged to tell their story, and we get to help amplify their story.
That's fantastic. So let's talk about Global Genes for a little bit. What is your role there? How did you discover them? And what is their, it sounds like they're doing an awful lot for the rare disease community in terms of advocacy, in terms of filmmaking, in terms of community support.
Yeah, in a way, I'm right back where I started. So you mentioned the blog post that Global Genes gave me an award for, and that was 2015, and that led me to go to their big event, this Patient Advocacy Summit. And that's where I met Bo Bigelow. And we kept in touch, and we compared notes about how he was telling his story of his daughter with USP7, and I was telling my son's story, and that led us to, yes, we have these films, but what do you do with them? You know, after you run the film festival circuit and after you put them up on YouTube, and then what? And we came up with the idea that maybe there could be a film festival and maybe we could be the ones to do it. So then years later, partly because of the pandemic, you know, people questioning, is my job meaningful? My job was making TV commercials. And so in some sense, I was selling soap or selling cars or selling reality TV stars, which can be fun and rewarding in a way, but isn't probably improving the world all that much. And so I was thinking about the work I did as a volunteer meant more to me. The rare disease stuff meant more to me. So shouldn't that be my day job too? And luckily I had the relationships with people at Global Genes. And when I brought that idea up, they said, yeah, we think you could be here too. So I am. It's been almost a year and a half about. They brought me in to launch an online community so that people concerned with rare disease would have basically the virtual version of that lobby experience, whether it's the lobby experience of my film festival or at a Global Genes event, where in addition to how great the scheduled content is, those people, like we were talking about, having a shared experience and then going out somewhere, the lobby, to talk about it, that's the real power. And Global Genes was looking at, even when pandemic's over and we go back to face-to-face events, we might only do 4 events a year. What does everybody do in the time between the events? And so that's the point of this thing we call the Rare Portal, which is an online discussion community. So that was the original focus of my work, still is. But in recent months, I've been pulled into a different focus, which is to get this giant advocacy summit going. And it's been a pleasure to have a role in deciding what the topics would be and who the speakers would be for those topics. So I was able to pull from a lot of people I've gotten to know from films, whether they were the filmmakers or the subjects of the films. I knew they'd be good speakers. I knew they had a powerful story, and I could keep tapping them and say, you know, sometimes it's you, or who do you know? You know, who else should I talk to? And so that's been a real pleasure to bring so many people that I've come to admire and respect. And in a few weeks, we'll all be in one place.
Yeah, that should be a fantastic event. I look forward to attending a future one, but where do you, does Global Genes also work on helping? I know it's a lot of advocacy. Where do they stand in terms of helping encourage or fund or get the medical community involved to, you know, bring more research into the equation or more effective research into the equation?
Yeah, there are a few ways. One program we have called Rare Compassion Program pairs medical students with people that are rare disease families so that they can learn directly from those families, you know, the firsthand experience. And so we'll have hundreds of medical students a year going through this program. And, you know, their typical medical school training is not going to touch on very many rare diseases at all. So they're going to get much more knowledge, at least about one or two rare diseases. And it can really reframe their understanding and their maybe level of compassion. So that's a good program. Another is directed more at researchers looking for treatments and cures. But what is the role of the patient advocacy organization? Right. So often the role is to be a funder. They're going to raise the money and they're going to give the money to the researcher. And that role even is changing because now we know our power. We can put strings attached to those dollars. We can say, for this money, we need to see these results, or we want to own a piece of the research results. When you produce a drug at the end, we're going to be a co-owner of that drug. So that's interesting. We're trying to prepare people to move along that path. But they might also be certainly the source of patients, right? If you've got a new drug in the works for the Fabry community, you better know who the patients are that have Fabry. And the advocacy organizations are a great connection point for that. And then many of them, and this is one of the things we try to get people ready for, and we have a program we call Ready, R-E-D-I, are developing more than just a registry of patients, but maybe a data bank, and that might include bio samples or health histories. And all of those things have value to the researcher, one, as the data itself, but that data lets them de-risk any new drug development is risky and is expensive. And to have more patient input and data up front brings down that risk a little bit, makes it a more attractive target for their work. So those are some of the ways Global Genes is working on that.
That's brilliant. It really is. How and where does I want to ask this question clearly, but when you're cooperating or collaborating with a researcher who's trying something new, where are like the tricky points in the advocacy there, right? Like, how are you making sure that those patients are being protected, that the drug companies are really looking after their best interests, that they're not trying something that they might know is not promising, but they need to push this drug to the market anyways because they've invested so many dollars in it? Like, there's a lot of, if this is, you know, off topic, that like too, you don't want to talk about this, that's fine. But I'm just curious as to how do you balance some of those dynamics, which are really complex and difficult to manage?
No, you're right. There are a lot of pitfalls like that to beware of. We are, in a way, a degree removed from that because we're an umbrella organization for all rare diseases. So we're unlikely to be at that direct connection on one particular disease's research, but our constituents would be, right? So if you're running the SYNGAP Research Foundation, you would find yourself in that scenario you just described. And so we are instead giving more general guidance of how to be prepared, what to expect, but not exactly making the decisions you're describing. But you're right, there are pitfalls that you would never think of. For example, everybody thinks they want a clinical trial, right? That sounds like hope. That sounds like the innovation that could make a difference in you or your child's life. But you may make yourself ineligible for the next clinical trial, having done one, right? And then you have to, it's a cruel calculus to make. Is next year's trial going to be more promising and you're going to wish you were in that one instead? I mean, there's a lot of aspects to consider here.
So like most things, just education is the first step, and guidance and making sure people understand what that calculus is as a starting point, rather than walking in kind of like you said, where it's easy to take the wrong path because of, like you said, hope, or this is gonna solve the problem, so to speak.
Yeah, I think a lot of the global genes efforts can be summed up in education on one hand and connections on the other. And so where our education doesn't maybe get as specific as any given person might need, that's the point where we hope to be able to say, but we know who you should be dealing with next, and let's connect you to that person, and they can take you farther down the path than we can.
That's powerful and really important work. Have I missed anything in this conversation that you feel is important to talk about?
You know, I feel like you and I could talk for a long time and cover a lot of topics, but there's one that's kind of on my mind so much, is that I think people facing a diagnosis or a sudden change of life that might leave them disabled, sometimes early on in that process, we don't understand the role of grief. And I think most people think about grieving deaths and not grieving other things. Like, I've come to find out maybe the hard way that, you know, you can grieve a diagnosis, you can grieve any shocking event in your life, any big change that was not wished for. And getting more comfortable as a society with what grief is and when it happens. And I appreciate the Kubler-Ross literature that told us there were, you know, 5 and then 6 stages of grief. But I really want to dispel the idea of stages, because it implies that you can check them off a list and work through them and be done with them. And I don't, from everyone I talk to and from my own experience, that is not what happens. There are waves that keep coming, and they'll probably come forever. But having the names for them does help. I just prefer not to call them stages.
Isn't there also a lot of shame around grief of, you know, something is, you tend to pull back and not connect and not talk to people about it because you're embarrassed, or there's social norms, or you're going to feel vulnerable or at risk. And that's like the exact opposite in many ways. Obviously we all need our personal space, but it's the exact opposite of what we need as people.
Yeah, you're right. I think it boils down to norms. We have rituals. We have rituals at a funeral or the time after a funeral where people will reach out and they'll do all the right things they can think to do, whether it's stop by for a visit or drop off a casserole or whatever that is. But then when the ritual is gone, it doesn't mean the grief's gone. and the need for that kind of support and connection isn't gone, but we don't have a playbook as a society for how to check back in. You know, should I check back in 1 month after the funeral, or, you know, 2 months, every month on the anniversary? You know, what are the, you know, if we did have rituals, it might help. And lacking them, I think all we can do is have conversations like this where we're pretty open about it. And, you know, it's okay to be grieving any number of days or years after the fact. It's not, I think the other aspect is that notion that when you talked about maybe it's looked down upon or misunderstood, or that we think it will pass. We think you'll get over it. So there's an expectation that some amount of time will handle this for you. Yes and no. I mean, it gets better with time. Does it get down to zero? No. So yeah, there's a great big conversation we had about that. We're going to have a couple of sessions at Global Genes on this, how to grieve as a community. You know, even if it's not your direct personal loss, it's just someone who shares the same disease. And so you have that connection, and that's a strong one, but it's not in the playbook, right? You might not be close enough to be the one who sends a card or attends a funeral. But you're connected, and it's an impact on you and your community too. We wanted to address that. So there's a lot to be had here, discussion to be had here. And I think some of what I heard in your conversation with BJ about palliative care, you know, there's a lot of misunderstanding and apprehension because it's associated with the idea of death. But it doesn't have to be, and it could be talked about differently. And so he's obviously doing great work on that. There's different conversations that need to happen to reframe some of our, what we used to think the words mean, and what they actually should be meaning. And, you know, I often have conversations about complex care because that sounds a little more palatable to people than palliative care. And, you know, BJ gets into where we came from with a hospice mentality, and, you know, that hospice implies death. And so we definitely have both within our community misunderstandings, but certainly those less directly affected by chronic illness or disability or rare disease or, you know, a short prognosis on the horizon, the people that don't feel the immediate need to think about these things probably could benefit from some of these conversations too. They just don't know it yet.
I mean, with, yeah, and BJ and one of the palliative care nurses that he works with that I have a lot of respect for, Lady Bird, they both say that they don't even talk about death anymore. It, like, working in palliative care has taught them how to appreciate life. And I think your experience with Lucas has taught you the same thing, right? So we do need to flip the script. We need to tell better stories. We need to maybe create the new language and the new rituals through film, right? Through how many, beyond, you know, the memes, but how many cultural shifts have there been from movies that we don't even think about, right? The art of storytelling through film has the ability to start to shape all of those things that you said we are missing, right? It's sense of community, it's sense of how do we respond to grief within ourselves, and how do we help the people around us with that, just by whatever it is. There's no playbook. Film has the possibility to change that.
Absolutely. I mean, it's my favorite medium. It's easy to think of it as the preeminent medium because it brings in so many of the other ones, right? It brings in music, it brings in written story, it brings in visual arts. And so you take all the powers of all those tools and you put them all together. You've got a lot of advantage at your from the get-go, right? For what's possible.
Right? Yep. And I think if we play, this is just a theory. I don't know if this is true, but I think that if we try to connect with people who are not going through these experiences directly, just through their curiosity, like if we find the people who are curious to learn, to explore, to see what other human experiences are like, I think that we can bring in a big percentage of the population that maybe doesn't seem interested right now.
Yeah, I agree. Yeah.
But Daniel, I really appreciate the time and yes, we could talk for hours. How can people connect with you? How can people learn more about what you're doing?
For Global Genes stuff, it's globalgenes.org. And there's also thedisorderchannel.com or rarediseasefilmfestival.com. And you can find Disorder Channel on probably most social media too.
Awesome. And I know it's available on Amazon, the Amazon Fire and the Rokus. Hopefully Apple next. What's going on with
yeah, that's with a little harder. That's a little harder technical challenge for us, but maybe someday. But you're right. First Roku devices and Fire TV devices, you can just search the Disorder Channel as you would try to add, you know, a Hulu or Netflix or HBO, the same kind of add channel function. And it's free. So
awesome. Well, thank you so much for the time. Thank you so much for the thoughtful conversation. You know, I look forward to the next one and to doing more together.
Yeah. Thank you for doing this, getting all these stories out there. It's good work.
Thank you.